fly and look past him into the apartment. The place was a shambles. Boxes overturned, books flung here and there, the mattress rolled up, the sheets and pillows on the floor. Half of Johnny's clothes had been pulled from the closet and piled in a heap. In the kitchen, through the doorway, I could see cabinet doors standing open, pots and pans strewn across the floor. While the disorder was extensive, nothing appeared to be damaged or destroyed. There was no sign that anyone had taken a blade to the bedding. No graffiti, no food emptied out of canisters or pipes torn from the walls. Vandals will often festoon the walls with their own fecal paint, but there was nothing like that here. It looked more like the methods big city cops might employ at the scene of a drug bust. But what was the object of the exercise? Fleetingly, I entertained the notion that I was being set up, called in as a witness to a phony crime scene, so that Bucky and his father could claim something valuable had been taken. Bucky appeared from the kitchen and caught sight of me. In one split second, we exchanged curiously guilty looks, like co-conspirators. There's something about being accused of criminal behavior that makes you feel like you did it even if you're innocent. Bucky turned to his dad.
Toilet tank's cracked. Might have been like that before, but I never noticed.
Chester pointed a finger.
You're paying for it if it has to be replaced. Bringing her into it was your bright idea.
He turned to me, jerking a thumb over his shoulder toward the bathroom.
You ought to see in there. Medicine cabinets pulled all the way out the wall.
He droned on, pouring out the details, which seemed to give him satisfaction. He probably liked to bitch, reciting his grievances in order to justify his ill treatment of other people. His irritation was contagious, and I could feel my temper climb. I cut into his monologue.
Hey, I didn't do this, Chester. You can rant and rave all you want, but the place was fine when I left. I locked up and put the key back through the mail slot like Bucky suggested. Ray Rawson was here. If you don't believe me, you can ask him.
Everybody's innocent. Nobody did nothing. Everybody's got some kind of bullshit excuse, Chester groused.
Dad, she didn't do it.
You let me take care of this.
He turned and looked at me narrowly.
You trying to say Ray Rawson did this?
Of course not. Why would he do this when he's hoping to move in? My voice was rising in response to his, and I worked to get control. Chester's attitude became grudging.
Well, you better have a talk with him and find out what he knows.
Why would he know anything? He left the same time I did. Bucky interceded, trying to introduce a note of reason.
Pappy didn't have a pot to piss in, so there's nothing here to take. Besides, he died in July. If burglars thought there was anything of value, why wait until now?
Maybe it was kids, I said.
We don't have kids in this neighborhood, as far as I know.
True enough, I said. Ours was primarily a community of retirees. It was always possible, of course, that a roving band of thugs had targeted the apartment. Maybe they figured that any place this crummy-looking had to be a cover for something good.
Nuts, Chester said with disgust. I'm going down and wait for the police. Soon as you two crime experts finish your analysis, you can get the place cleaned up.
I gave him a look. I'm not going to clean the damn place.
I wasn't talking to you, he said. Bucky, you and Babe get busy.
You better wait for the cops, I said. He swung around and stared at me.
Why is that?
Because this is a crime scene. The cops might want to dust for prints. Chester's face seemed to darken.
This is bullshit. There's something not right about this.
He made a motion in my direction.
You can come on down with me.
I glanced back at Bucky. I wouldn't touch anything if I were you. You don't want to screw around with evidence.
I hear you,
he said. Chester gestured impatiently for me to pick up the pace. On the way down the steps, I glanced at my watch. It was 1:15, and already I was tired of taking crap from this guy. I'll take crap when I'm paid for it, but I don't like doing it without compensation. Chester clumped into the kitchen and went straight to the refrigerator, where he jerked open the door. He took out a jar of mayonnaise, mustard, bottled hot sauce, a packet of bologna, and a loaf of Wonder white bread. Had he ordered me to come down here so I could supervise his lunch?
I apologize if I was rough, but I don't like what's going on, he said gruffly. He wasn't looking at me, and I was tempted to do a double take to see if there was someone else in the room. He'd dropped the imperious attitude and was talking in a normal tone of voice.
You have a theory? I'll get to that in a bit. Grab a chair.
At least he had my attention. I took a seat at the kitchen table and watched in fascination as he started his preparations. Somehow in my profession, I seem to spend a lot of time in kitchens looking on while men make sandwiches, and I can state categorically, they do it better than women. Men are fearless. They have no interest in nutrition and seldom study the list of chemicals provided on the package. I've never seen a man cut the crusts off the bread or worry about the aesthetics of the presentation. Forget the sprig of parsley and the radish rosette. With men, it's strictly a grunt-and-munch operation.
Chester banged a cast-iron skillet on the burner, flipped the gas on, and tossed in a knuckle of butter, which began to sizzle within seconds.
I sent Bucky out to live with his granddad, which turned out to be a mistake. I figured the two of them could look after each other. Next thing I know, Bucky's hooked up with that gal. I got nothing against Babe. She's a dimwit, but so's he. I just think the two of them got no business being married.
Johnny didn't warn you?
Hell, he probably encouraged it. Anything to make trouble. He was a sneaky old coot.
I let that one pass, leaving him to tell the story his way. There was an interval of quiet while he tended to his cooking. The bologna was pale pink, the size of a bread-and-butter plate, a perfect circle of compacted piggy byproducts. Chester tossed in the meat without even pausing to remove the rim of plastic casing. While the bologna was frying, he slathered mayonnaise on one slice of bread and mustard on the other. He shook hot sauce across the yellow mustard in perfect red polka dots. As a child, I was raised with the same kind of white bread, which had the following amazing properties. If you mashed it, it instantly reverted to its unbaked state. A loaf of this bread, inadvertently squished at the bottom of a grocery bag, was permanently injured and made very strange-shaped sandwiches. On the plus side, you could roll it into little pellets and flick them across the table at your aunt when she wasn't looking. If one of these bread boogers landed in her hair, she would slap at it, irritated, thinking it was a fly. I can still remember the first time I ate a piece of the neighbor's homemade white bread, which seemed as coarse and dry as a cellulose sponge. It smelled like empty beer bottles, and if you gripped it, you couldn't even see the dents your fingers made in the crust. The air in the kitchen was now scented with browning bologna, which was curling up around the edges to form a little bowl with butter puddled in the center.
End of Disc 1. Disc 2.
The air in the kitchen was now scented with browning bologna, which was curling up around the edges to form a little bowl with butter puddled in the center. I could feel myself getting dizzy from the sensory overload. I said, "I'll pay you $400 if you fix me one of those." Chester glanced at me sharply, and for the first time he smiled.
"You want toasted?"
"You're the chef. It's your choice," I said.
While we chowed down, I decided to satisfy my curiosity as well.
"What sort of work do you do back in Columbus?"
He snapped back the last of his sandwich like a starving dog, wiping his mouth on a paper napkin before he responded.
"Own a little print shop in Bexley, offset and letterpress. Cold and hot type, brochures, flyers, business cards, custom stationery. I can collate, fold, bind, and staple. You name it. I just hired a guy who looks after the place when I'm gone. He does good, I'll let him buy me out. Time I did something else. I'm too young to retire, but I'm tired of working for a living."
"What would you do, come out here to live?"
Chester fired up a cigarette, a Camel unfiltered that smelled like burning hay.
"Don't know yet. I grew up in this town, but I left as soon as I turned 18. Pappy came out here in 1945, which is when he bought this place. He always said he'd be in this house until the sheriff or the undertaker hauled him out by his feet. Him and me never could get along. He's rough as a cob, and talk about child abuse. You never heard about that in the old days. I know a lot of guys got knocked around back then. That's just what dads did. They came home from the factory, sucked down a few beers, and grabbed the first kid came handy. I've been punched and kicked, flung against the wall, and called every name in the book. If I got in trouble, he'd make me pace until I dropped, and if I uttered one word of protest, he'd douse my tongue with Tabasco sauce. I hated it, hated my old man for doing it, but I just thought that's the way life was. Now all you have to do is pop a kid across the face in public, you're up on charges, buddy, looking at jail time. Foster home for the kid and the whole community up in arms.
I guess some things change for the better, I remarked.
You got that right. I vowed I'd never treat my kids that way, and that's a promise I kept. I never once raised a hand to him.
I looked at him, waiting for some rueful acknowledgement of his own abusiveness. But he didn't seem to make the connection. I moved the subject over slightly. Your father died of a heart attack?
Chester took a drag of his cigarette, removing a piece of tobacco from his tongue.
Killed over in the yard. Doctor told him he better lay off the fat. He sat down one Saturday to a big plate of bacon and eggs, fried sausages and hashed browns, 4 cups of coffee and a cigarette. He pushed his chair back, said he wasn't feeling so hot, and headed out to his place. Never even reached the stairs. Coronary occlusion is the term they used. Autopsy showed an opening in his artery no bigger than a thread.
I take it you don't think his death is related to the break-in.
I don't think he was murdered, if that's what you're getting at. But there might be some connection.
Indirectly, he said. He studied the ember on the end of his cigarette.
You have to understand something about my old man. He was paranoid. He liked passwords and secret knocks, all this 007 rigmarole. There were things he didn't like to talk about, the war being foremost. Once in a while, if he was tanked up on whiskey, he'd rattle off at the mouth, but you ask him a question and he'd clam right up.
What do you think it was?
Well, I'm getting to that, but let me point this out first. You see, it strikes me as odd, this whole sequence of events. Old guy dies, and that should have been the end of it. Except Bucky gets the bright idea of applying for these benefits, and that's what tips him off.
Tips who?
The government.
The government, I said. He leaned forward, lowering his voice.
I think my old man was hiding from the feds.
I stared at him. Why?
Well, I'll tell you. All the years since the war, he never once applied for benefits. No disability, no medical, no GI Bill. Now, why is that?
I give up. He smiled slightly, unperturbed by the fact that I wasn't buying in.
Clown around if you like, but take a look at the facts. We fill out a claim form. All the information's correct. But first, they say they have no record of him, which is bullshit. Fabrication, pure and simple. What do you mean they don't have a record of him? This is nonsense. Of course they do. Will they admit it? No, ma'am. You following? So I get on the phone to Randolph. That's the Air Force base where all the files are kept. And I go through the whole routine again. And I get stonewalled, but good. So I call the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis. No deal. Never heard of him. Then I call Washington, D.C. We're talking the Pentagon here. Nothing. No record.
Well, I'm being dense. I'm not getting it myself. All I know to do is raise 6 kinds of hell. I make it clear we're serious about this. A lousy $300, but I don't give a good goddamn. I'm not going to let it drop.
The man served his country, and he's entitled to a decent burial. What do I get? Same deal. They don't own nothing from nothing. Then we have this.
He jerked a thumb toward the garage apartment.
See what I'm saying?
No.
Well, think about it.
I waited. I didn't have the faintest idea what he was getting at. He took a deep drag from his cigarette.
You want to know what I think?
He paused, creating drama, maximizing the effect.
I think it took him this long to get some boys out here to find out how much we knew.
This sentence was so loaded, I couldn't figure out which part to parse first. I tried not to sound exasperated. About what?
About what he did during the war,
he said, as though to a nitwit.
I think the old man was military intelligence.
A lot of guys worked in military intelligence. So what?
That's right. But he never admitted it, never said a word. And you know why?
I think he was a double agent. Oh, stop this. A spy?
In some capacity, yes. Information gathering. I think that's why his records are sealed.
You think his records are sealed? And that's why you can't get verification from the VA, I said, restating his point.
Bullseye!
He pointed a finger at me and gave me a wink, as though I'd finally picked up the requisite IQ points. I looked at him blankly. This was beginning to feel like one of those discussions with a UFO fanatic, where the absence of documentation is taken for proof of government suppression.
Are you saying he worked for the Germans or spied on them for our side?
Not the Germans, the Japanese. I think he might have worked for them, but I can't be sure. He was over in Burma. He admitted that much.
Why would that be such a big deal all these years later?
You tell me.
Well, how would I know? Honestly, Chester, I can't speculate about this stuff. I never even knew your father. I have no way of guessing what he was up to, if anything.
I'm not asking you to speculate. I'm asking you to be objective. Why else would they say he wasn't in the Air Force? Give me one good reason.
So far, you don't have any proof that he was.
Why would he lie? The man wouldn't lie about a thing like that. You're missing the point.
No, I'm not. The point is, they're not really saying he wasn't there, I said. They're saying they can't identify him from the information you submitted. There must be 100 John Lees, probably more.
With his exact date of birth and his social security number? Come on, you think this stuff isn't on computer? All they have to do is type it in. Press enter. Boom, they got him. So why would they deny it?
What makes you think they have all this data on computer, I said, just to be perverse. This was hardly the issue, but I was feeling argumentative.
What makes you think they don't?
I barely suppressed a groan. I was hating this conversation, but I couldn't find any way to get out of it.
Come on, Chester. Let's don't do this, okay?
You asked the question. I'm just answering.
Oh, forget it. Have it your way. Let's say he was a spy, just for the sake of argument. That was 40-some-odd years ago. The man is dead now, so why does anybody give a shit?
Maybe they don't care about him. Maybe they care about something he has. Maybe he took something that belongs to them. Now they want it back.
You are making me crazy. What it?
How do I know? Files, documents? This is just a hunch.
I wanted to lay my little head on the table and weep from frustration. Chester, this makes no sense.
Why not?
Because if that's the case, why call attention to it? Why not just pay you the $300? Then they can come out at their leisure and look for this thing, this whatever you think he has. If he's been in hiding all these years, if they've really been looking and now they know his whereabouts, why arouse your suspicions by refusing to pay some dinky little $300 claim?
$450 with interment thrown in, he said.
I conceded the arithmetic. $450 then, I said. The same question applies. Why cock around?
Hey, I can't explain why the government does what it does. If these guys were so bright, they'd have tracked him down years ago. The VA application was the tip-off, that's all I'm saying.
I took a deep breath. You're jumping to conclusions. He stubbed out his cigarette.
Of course I'm jumping. The question is, am I right? The way I see it, the boys finally got a lock on him, and that's the result.
He tipped his head in the direction of the garage apartment.
Here's the only question I got. Did they find what they came for, or is it still hidden somewhere? I'll tell you something else. This Rawson fellow could be part of it.
This time I groaned and put my head in my hands. This was making my neck tense, and I massaged my trapezius.
Well, look, it's an interesting hypothesis, and I wish you a lot of luck. All I offered was to see if I could locate a set of dog tags or a photograph. You want to turn this into some kind of spy ring? It's not my line of work. Thanks for the sandwich. You're a genius with bologna.
Chester's gaze suddenly shifted to a spot just behind me. There was a sharp rap at the back door, and I felt myself jump. Chester got up.
Police,
he said under his breath.
Just act normal.
He moved toward the door to let the guy in while I turned and squinted at him.
Act normal? Why wouldn't I act normal? I am normal.
On the back step, I could hear the uniformed police officer's murmured introduction. Chester ushered him into the kitchen.
I appreciate your coming out. This is my neighbor, Kinsey Milhone. Officer Wettig,
he said, using this phony Mr. Good Citizen tone of voice. I glanced at the officer's name tag. P. Wettig. Paul, Peter, Philip. This was not anyone I knew from my dealings with the department. Gutierrez and Pettigrew had always handled this beat. Despite my skepticism, Chester's conspiracy theory was apparently having an effect, because I was already wondering if his 911 call had been intercepted and an imposter sent instead. Wettig was probably in his late 40s, looking more like a lounge singer than a uniformed patrolman. He wore his blonde hair long, pulled into a little pigtail in back. Brown eyes, short blunt nose, round chin. I pegged him at 6'3", weighing in at 210. The uniform looked authentic, but wasn't he a little old to be a beat cop? Hi, how are you? I said, shaking hands. I expected to see Gerald Pettigrew and Maria Gutierrez. Wettig's look was neutral, his tone of voice bland.
They split up. Pettigrew's on traffic now, and Maria moved over to the county sheriff's department.
Really? I hadn't heard that. I glanced at Chester. You want me to stay? I can hang around if you like.
Don't worry about it. I can call you later.
He glanced at Officer Wettig.
I guess I better show you the apartment.
I watched as Chester and the officer walked down the back steps and across the concrete drive. As soon as they were out of sight, I moved down the hallway and peered out the front. A black and white patrol car was parked at the curb. I found the telephone, which was located in what looked like a little prayer niche in the hall. I pulled out the telephone directory and dialed the regular phone line for the Santa Teresa Police Department. Someone in records answered. I said, "Oh, hi. Can you tell me if Officer Wettig is working this shift?" "Just a second and I'll check." She clicked off, putting me on hold. Moments later, she clicked back in again.
"He's on until 3 this afternoon. You want to leave a message?"
"No, thanks. I'll try again later," I said, and hung up. Belatedly, I blushed, feeling slightly sheepish. Of course there was an Officer Wettig. What was wrong with me? Chapter 4. After I left Bucky's, I came home and took a brief but refreshing nap, which I suspected even then was going to be one of the highlights of my vacation. At 4:57, I ran a brush through my hair and trotted down the spiral stairs. The lowering cloud cover was generating an aura of early twilight, and the street lights winked on as I locked my apartment. Even with the late afternoon drop in temperature, Henry's back door was open. Raucous laughter spilled through the screen door, along with a tantalizing array of cooking smells. Henry was playing some kind of honky-tonk piano in the living room. I crossed the flagstone patio and knocked on the screen. Preparations for Lewis's birthday dinner were already underway. For his birthday, I'd bought a sterling silver shaving set, with a mug and a brush, that I'd found in an antique store. It was more collectible than antique, but I thought it would be something he could either use or admire. Lewis was polishing silverware, but he let me in. He'd taken off his suit coat, but he still wore dress pants, a vest, crisp white shirt with the sleeves rolled up. Charlie had one of Henry's aprons tied around his waist, and he was in the process of putting the finishing touches on Lewis's birthday cake. Henry had told me Charlie was becoming self-conscious because his hearing had deteriorated so much. He'd had his hearing officially tested about 5 years before. At that point, the audiologist had recommended hearing aids, for which Charlie had been fitted. He'd worn them for a week or so and then put them in a drawer. He said the ones he tried felt like someone had a thumb in each ear. Every time he flushed the toilet, it sounded like Niagara Falls. Combing his hair sounded like someone walking on gravel. He didn't see what was wrong with people talking loud enough for him to hear. Most of the time, he had a hand cupped to his right ear. He said, "What?" quite a lot. The others tended to ignore him. The cake he was working on had listed to one side, and he was using an extra inch of white frosting to prop it up. He glanced up at me.
"We don't let the birthday person bake his own birthday cake," he said. "Nell does the layers, unless it's her birthday, of course, and I do boiled frosting, which she never seems to get right."
"Everything smells great." I lifted the lid to a covered casserole. Inside there was a mass of something lumpy and white, with what looked like pimento, hard-boiled egg, and clumps of pickle relish.
"What's this?"
"Say again?"
Lewis spoke up.
"That started out as potato salad, but Charlie set the timer and never heard it ring, so the potatoes cooked down to mush. We decided to add all the regular ingredients and call it Charlie Pitt's Famous Mashed Potato Salad. We're also having fried chicken, baked beans, coleslaw, deviled eggs, and sliced cucumbers and tomatoes with vinegar. I've had this same meal every birthday for the last 86 years, since I was 2, he said. We each have something special, and the rule in our family is that the siblings cook. Some are better than others, as it turns out, he added with a glance at Charlie.
I turned to Charlie. What do you have for your birthday?
What's that?
I raised my voice and repeated my question.
Oh, hot dogs, chili, dill pickles, and potato chips. Mother used to fuss because I refused to have a proper vegetable, but I insisted on potato chips, and she finally gave in. Instead of birthday cake, I always ask for a pan of Henry's brownies, which he usually has to send halfway across the country.
What about Henry? Charlie cupped a hand to his ear, and Lewis answered for him.
Country ham, biscuits with red-eye gravy, collard greens, black-eyed peas, and cheese grits. Now she insists on meatloaf, mashed potatoes, green beans, and apple pie with a big wedge of cheddar cheese on top. Never varies.
William came into the kitchen in time to catch Lewis's last remark.
What doesn't? I was telling Kinsey about our birthday dinners.
I smiled at William. What's yours? Lewis cut in again.
William always begs for a New England boiled dinner, but we vote him down.
Well, I like it, he said staunchly.
Oh, you do not. Nobody could like a New England boiled dinner. You just say that because you know the rest of us would be forced to eat it as well.
So what does he end up with?
Anything we feel like cooking, Lewis said with satisfaction.
We heard a tap at the back door. I turned and saw that Rosie had arrived. The minute she and William saw each other, their faces lighted up. There were seldom any public displays of affection between them, but there was no doubt about their devotion. He was undismayed by her crankiness, and she took his hypochondria in stride. As a consequence, he complained less about imaginary ailments, and her sour moods had diminished. Tonight she was decked out in a dark red muumuu with a purple and navy paisley shawl, the rich colors adding a note of drama to her vibrantly dyed red hair. She seemed relaxed. I'd always thought of her as someone abysmally shy, ill at ease with strangers, overbearing with friends. She tended to be quite flirtatious with men, barely tolerant of women, and oblivious of kids. At the same time, she tyrannized the restaurant staff, paying them the lowest wages she could get away with. William and I were forever trying to persuade her to loosen up the purse strings. As for me, she'd bullied me unmercifully since the day I'd moved into the neighborhood. She wasn't mean, but she was opinionated, and she never seemed to hesitate in making her views known. Since I'd begun eating most of my dinners at the restaurant, she'd routinely told me what to order, ignoring any tastes or requirements of mine. Though I like to think of myself as hard-assed, I'd never had the nerve to stand up to her. My only defense in the face of her dictatorship was passive resistance. So far, I'd refused to get a husband or a dog, two apparently interchangeable elements she considered essential for my safety. Now that she was poised on the brink of matrimony, she seemed at peace with herself, playful, full of smiles. William's siblings had accepted her without a moment's hesitation. Except for Henry, of course, who was dumbfounded when the two connected. I began to see the wedding not so much as a union between her and William, but as an official ceremony by which she'd be initiated into the tribe. From the other room, Henry began to pound out his rendition of Happy Birthday to Louis, which he belted out at top volume. We joined him in a sing-along that continued for an hour before we ate. After dinner, Henry drew me aside.
What's the story on the break-in?
I'm not really sure. Chester seems to think there's some nefarious plot afoot, but I have trouble buying it. Somebody broke in. There's no doubt about that. I'm just not sure it has anything to do with his dad.
Chester thinks there's a link?
He thinks it's all connected. I think the guy's seen too many bad movies. He suspects Johnny was a double agent during World War II and somehow has this stash of stolen documents in his possession. He feels the VA claim was what alerted the government, and that's who broke in. Henry's look was confused.
Who did?
The CIA, I guess. Somebody who finally figured out where the old man was hiding. Anyway, that's his theory, and as they say, he's sticking to it.
I'm sorry I got you into it. Chester sounds like a nut.
Don't worry about it. It's not like he actually hired me, so what difference does it make?
Well, it sounds like you did what you could, and I appreciate that. I owe you one.
Oh, you do not, I said with a wave of my hand. In the years of our friendship, Henry had done so much for me, I would never catch up. At 10, when they hauled out the Monopoly board and the popcorn paraphernalia, I excused myself and went home. I knew the game would continue until midnight or 1, and I wasn't up to it. Not old enough, I guess. I slept like a stone until 6:14 a.m., when I caught the alarm mere seconds before it was set to ring. I rolled out of bed and pulled on my sweats in preparation for my run. Through the spring and summer months, I run at 6, but in winter the sun doesn't rise until nearly 7. By then I like to be out on the path. I've been jogging since I was 25, 3 miles a day, usually 6 days a week, barring illness, injury, or an attack of laziness, which doesn't happen often. My eating patterns are erratic and my diet is appalling, so the run is my way of atoning for my sins. While I'm not crazy about the pain, I'm a sucker for the exhilaration. And I do love the air at that hour of the day. It's chilly and moist. It smells of ocean and pine and eucalyptus and mown grass. By the time I cool down, walking back to my place, the sun has streaked across the lawns, unrolling all the shadows behind the trees, turning dew to mist. There's no moment so satisfying as the last moment of a run. Chest heaving, heart pounding, sweat pouring down my face. I bend from the waist and bark out a note of pure bliss, relieved of tension, stress, and the residual effects of all the quarter pounders with cheese. I finished my run and did a cool-down walking home. I let myself into the apartment, took a shower, and got dressed. I was just spooning down the last of my cold cereal when the telephone rang. I glanced at the clock. It was 7:41. Not an hour at which I would ordinarily expect the world to intrude. I grabbed the phone on the second ring. Hello?
Hey, it's me, Chester. Hope I'm not bothering you, he said.
This is fine. What are you doing at this hour?
Was that you I seen running along Cabana a little while ago?
Yes, I said cautiously. Is that what you called to ask, or was there something else?
No, no, not at all. I just wondered, he said. I got something I want to show you. We came across it last night.
What kind of it?
Just come over and take a look. It's something Bucky discovered when he was cleaning out Pappy's place. I wouldn't let anyone touch nothing till you saw for yourself. You might have to eat crow.
He sounded nearly gleeful. Give me 5 minutes. I rinsed my dish and my spoon, put the cereal and the milk away, and ran a damp sponge across the kitchen counter. One of the joys of living alone is the only mess you clean up is the one you just made. I tucked my keys in my jacket pocket, pulled the door shut, and took off. In the time since I'd run, the neighborhood was coming alive. I spotted Louis halfway down the block, taking his morning constitutional. Mosa Lowenstein was sweeping off her front porch, and a fellow with a parrot on his shoulder was out walking his dog. This was one of those perfect November days, with cool air, high sun, and the lingering smell of wood fires from the night before. Along our block, the palm trees and evergreens provide constants in a landscape that seems to shift subtly with the passing seasons. Even in California, we experience a rendition of autumn, a sporadic mix of colors provided by the ginkgo, the sweet gum, the red oak, and white birch. An occasional maple tree might punctuate the foothills with an exclamation point of vibrant red, but the brightest hues are supplied by the blaze of forest fires that sweep through annually. This year, the arsonists had struck 4 times across the state, leaving thousands of acres in ashen gray, as eerie and as barren as the moon. When I got to Bucky's, I circled the main house and walked up the drive. The crudely patched concrete parking pad was littered with assorted cardboard boxes, and I assumed that progress was being made with Johnny's personal effects. I headed up the wooden stairs to the apartment above. The door was standing open, and I could hear the murmur of voices. I stepped through the doorway and paused in the entrance. Without the maze of bulky boxes, the place looked smaller and dingier. The furniture remained, but the room seemed almost imperceptibly diminished. Bucky and Chester were standing near the closet, which had been emptied of the remaining clothes. Both men were wearing versions of the same short-sleeved nylon Hawaiian shirt. Bucky's in neon green, Chester's in hot blue. Nearby, Babe was folding and packing the garments into an old steamer trunk. Coat hangers were piled up to the right of her as each piece of clothing was removed. She was wearing her usual flip-flops, along with shorts and a tank top. I had to admire the comfort with which she occupied her overblown body. I'd have been cold in that outfit, but it didn't seem to bother her. Chester smiled when he saw me.
"Hey, there you are. We were just talking about you. Come over here and take a look at this. See what you think."
Mr. Friendly, I thought. Bucky stepped back, showing me a panel he'd swung away from the back wall of the closet. A small residential safe had been tucked into the space, encased in what appeared to be a block of poured concrete. The safe door was approximately 16 inches wide and 14 inches tall. The panel itself appeared to be carefully constructed, a flush-mounted plywood partition with inset hinges. The magnetic latch looked to be spring-loaded and probably released at a touch.
"Impressive. How'd you find that?"
I asked. Bucky smiled sheepishly, clearly pleased with himself.
"We'd emptied the closet and I was sweeping it out when I bumped my broom handle up against the back wall. Sounded funny to me, so I got a flashlight and started looking at it real close, you know, knocking across the wall. Seemed like there was something goofy about this one section, so I gave it a push and this panel popped open."
I hunkered down in front of the opening, peering into the cavity that had been hidden in the found space between the joists. The front face of the safe was imposing, but that might have been deceptive. Most home safes are not built to withstand a professional burglar with the proper tools and sufficient time to force his way in. The safe I was looking at was more likely a fire safe, in which what appears to be a solid steel wall is only a thin metal outer shell filled with insulating material. The function of such a safe is protection from a home fire of fairly short duration. Insulation in an old safe might be something as basic as natural cement. A more modern safe might rely on vermiculite mica, or diatomaceous earth, particles of which can often be traced back from a burglary suspect's tools and clothing to the specific safe manufacturer. On closer inspection, I could see the safe wasn't actually embedded in concrete. The concrete formed a sort of housing into which the safe had been shoved.
"We got a locksmith on his way," Chester said. "I couldn't stand the wait, so I called an emergency number and told him to send somebody out. We could have all the answers right behind this dial."
He was probably picturing maps and ciphers, a small wireless radio, a Luger, and transmission schedules written in invisible ink.
"Have you looked for the combination? It's possible he wrote it down and tucked it someplace close.
Most people don't trust their memories, and if he'd needed to get into it, he wouldn't want to waste time searching."
"We thought of that, but we looked every place we could think of. What about you? You searched pretty good yourself. You come across anything might be the combination to that?"
I shrugged. I never came across any numbers, unless he was using his birth date or social security.
"Can they do that?" Bucky asked. "Make up a combination to suit any set of numbers you give?"
I shrugged. "As far as I know. I'm not an expert, but I always assumed you could do that."
What do you think? Should we pull that thing out?
Chester asked. Couldn't hurt. The locksmith will probably have to do it anyway once he gets here, I said. I rose to my feet and stepped out of the closet, allowing Bucky and Chester sufficient room to maneuver the safe from its resting place. It took a fair amount of huffing and puffing before they managed to set it down on the floor in the middle of the room. Once they'd eased the safe out of its concrete housing, we could take a better look. The three of us inspected the exterior surfaces as if this were some mysterious object that had appeared from outer space. The safe was maybe 16 inches deep, with a two-tone beige and gray finish and rubber mounting feet. It didn't look old. The dial was calibrated with numbers from 1 to 100, which meant you could generate close to 1 million combinations. There wasn't any point in trying to guess the right one. Babe had abandoned her packing and was watching the whole procedure.
Maybe it's open, she said to no one in particular.
We turned in unison and looked at her.
Well, it could be, she said.
It's worth a try, I said. I reached down and pulled the handle, without success. I turned the dial a few numbers in one direction and then the other, still pulling the handle, thinking the dial might have been left close to the last digit in the combination. No such luck.
What do we do now? Bucky asked.
I guess we wait, I said. Within the hour, the safe technician arrived with a big red metal toolbox. He introduced himself as Bergen Jones from Santa Teresa Locksmiths, shaking hands first with Chester, then with Bucky and me. Babe had gone back to folding clothes, but she nodded at him shyly when he was introduced to her. Jones was tall and bony-looking, sandy-haired, stoop-shouldered, with a high, shiny forehead, sandy brows, and big glasses with tortoiseshell frames. I placed him in his middle 50s, but I could have been off 5 years in either direction.
"Hope you can help us out here," Chester said,
waving at the safe, which Jones had already spotted.
"No problem. I probably open 30 safes a month. I know this model. Shouldn't take me long."
The four of us stood and watched in fascination as Jones opened his toolbox. There was something in his manner of an old-fashioned doctor on a house call. He'd made his initial diagnosis, the condition wasn't fatal, and we all felt relief. Now it was just a matter of the proper treatment. He took out a cone-shaped device that he attached to the dial, screwing it down tightly. Within minutes, he'd popped the dial off and set it aside, then removed the two screws holding the dial ring in place, slipped off the ring, and set it with the dial. Next, he took out an electric drill and began to bore a hole through the metal in the area that had been covered by the dial and ring.
"You just drill right through?" Babe said.
She sounded disappointed, perhaps hoping for dynamite caps or nitroglycerin. Jones smiled.
"I wouldn't put it quite like that. This is a residential fire safe. If this were a burglary safe, we'd run into hard plate. Barrier material just behind this steel plating. I got a pressure bar for that, but it'd still take me 30 minutes to drill a quarter-inch hole. A lot of them have auxiliary spring-loaded relocking devices. You hit the wrong spot, and you can fire the relockers. If this happens, it gets a lot worse before it gets better again." "This is easy."
We were quiet while he drilled, the low-pitched whine of metal making conversation awkward. The hair on the backs of his hands was a fine gold, his fingers long, wrists narrow. He was smiling to himself, as if he knew something the rest of us hadn't considered yet. Or maybe he was just a man who enjoyed his work. As soon as a hole had been drilled, he took out another device.
"What's that?" I asked. "Ophthalmoscope," he said. "Gadget your doctor uses to peer in your eyes. This shines light on the combination wheels so I can see what we got going."
He began to peer into the newly drilled hole, moving closer while flicking an outer dial on the scope to adjust the focal length. While squinting through his ophthalmoscope, he carefully rotated the protruding spindle stub to the left.
"This turns the drive wheel, which in turn picks up the third combination wheel. The third wheel moves the second wheel,
which then turns the first wheel, he said. It takes 4 rotations to get the first wheel moving. That's the one closest to the front of the safe. Here it comes. Perfect. The gate's exactly under the fence. Now we'll just keep reversing the direction of our rotation and lessening the numbers of turns. Soon as I get all 3 wheels lined up, the fence will be in position to drop when the lever nose hits the gate in the drive wheel. We keep turning, and the lever pulls back the lock bolt, and it's all over. With that, he gave the handle a pull, and the safe door opened. Chester, Bucky, and I gave out a simultaneous, "Ooh," like we were watching fireworks. Babe said, "Heck, it's empty."
"They must have got it already. God damn," Chester said.
"Got what?" Babe said, but he ignored the question, shooting her a cross look. While Bergen Jones wrote down the combination and put his tools away, Bucky peered into the safe, then got down on his back like an auto mechanic and shone a light into the interior.
"Something taped up here, Dad."
I leaned over and peered with him. An item had been secured to the top of the safe, a lumpy-looking 10-inch by 10-inch square of beige tape. Chester stepped over Bucky's legs and crouched by the safe, squinting at the patch.
"What is that? Peel it off and give it here. Let me take a look at that thing."
Gingerly, Bucky loosened one corner, then pulled it away like a Band-Aid from a wound. A big iron key adhered to the tape. It appeared to be an old-fashioned iron skeleton key with simple cuts in the end. He held it up.
"Anybody recognize this?"
"Beats me," I said, and then turned to Chester. "You know what it is?"
"Nope, but Pappy used to fool around with locks, now I think of it. He got a kick out of it. He liked to take a lock out of a door and file a key to fit."
"I never saw him do that," Bucky said.
"This is when I was a kid. He worked for a locksmith during the Depression. I remember him telling me what a hoot it was. He had this collection of old locks, probably close to 100 of them, but I haven't seen them for years."
I turned the key over in my hand. The design was ornate, the hand scalloped, with a hole in the other end like a skate key. Viewed straight on, the bit was shaped almost like a question mark. The lock and keyhole would be odd-looking, to say the least. "You don't remember anything like it around here?" Chester's mouth pulled down.
"Not me. What about you guys? You know the place better than I do at this point."
Bucky shook his head, and Babe gave a little shrug. I held the key out to Bergen Jones. "Any ideas?" Jones smiled slightly, snapping down the locks on his toolbox.
"Looks like a gate key. One of those big old iron jobs like they have on estates."
He turned to Chester.
"You want me to bill you on this?" "I'll write you a check. Come on down to the kitchen and we'll take care of it. You probably gathered by now my pappy died a few months back. We're still trying to get his affairs sorted out. The safe came as a big surprise. People ought to leave instructions. What the hell this is and who's supposed to get that? Anyways, we do appreciate your help. That's what I'm in business to do."
The two men departed, leaving Bucky, Babe, and me to contemplate the key. Bucky said,
"Now what?"
"I have a friend who knows a lot about locks," I said. "He might have a suggestion about what kind of lock this might fit."
"Might as well. Won't do us any good otherwise."
Babe took the key and inspected it, frowning.
"Maybe Pappy kept it because he liked the way it looked," she said. "It's neat. It's old-timey."
She handed it to Bucky, who passed it back to me.
"Yeah, but why bother to keep it in a fireproof safe? He could have stuck it in a drawer. He could have wore it on a chain around his neck," he said.
"If you don't object, I'll see what my local expert has to say."
"Fine with me," Bucky said.
I slipped the key in my jeans pocket without mentioning the fact that my local expert was the burglar, who'd also given me the set of key picks I carry in my handbag. Walking back to my place, I found myself reviewing the entire sequence of events. I have to confess, the past 24 hours had piqued my curiosity.
It wasn't necessarily Chester's spy theory, which still seemed far-fetched. What bothered me were the vague, unanswered questions surfacing in the old man's life. I like order and tidiness. No clutter and no dust bunnies hidden under the bed. As soon as I got home, I sat down at my desk, pulled out a pack of index cards, and started making notes. It was amazing how many details I could actually recall once I began committing them to paper. When I'd exhausted the subject, I pinned the cards up on the corkboard that hangs above my desk. I put my feet up on the desk and leaned back in my swivel chair with my hands locked behind my head and studied the whole collection. Something wasn't right, but I couldn't figure out what it was. I shifted some cards around and pinned them up in a new configuration. It was something I'd read. Burma. Something about Chenault and the American Volunteer Group. For the moment, the truth eluded me, but I knew it was there. I thought about nailing down the unit he'd served in. Was that really the issue here, or was there something else at stake? In scanning Johnny's books, I'd seen several AVG fighter pilots mentioned by name. One or more of those guys had to be alive today. Couldn't they provide a way to pinpoint Johnny's fighter group? It'd be a pain in the ass, and I sure wasn't going to do it, but I could at least steer Chester in the right direction. I'd have to check back through the books and see if I could find the reference. But what the hell? I wasn't doing anything else. Besides, once I start worrying a knot, I can't let go of it. I put in a call to my burglar friend, whose number had been disconnected. Rats. Later in the morning, I'd try the Santa Teresa Police Department. Detective Halpern in Major Crimes would probably know where he was. Chapter 5. By 10 a.m., I found myself back at Bucky's. I knocked on the door, but after several minutes went by and nobody answered, I headed down the driveway toward the back. The miscellaneous collection of cardboard boxes had been shoved to one side to make the driveway passable. The garage door on the left was standing open, and the Buick was missing. Maybe the three of them had gone out to breakfast. The other half of the two-car garage was piled high with junk, an impenetrable mountain of boxes, old furniture, appliances, and lawn care equipment. The cardboard box full of World War II books was right on top. I dragged it over to the stairs and made myself comfortable while I sorted through the contents. I finally found what I was looking for at the bottom of the box in a book called Fighter, The Story of Air Combat, 1936-45, by Robert Jackson. On 4 July 1942, the American Volunteer Group officially ceased to be an independent fighting unit and became part of the newly activated China Air Task Force, under command of the 10th Air Force. Command of the CATF devolved on Claire Chenault, who exchanged his Chinese uniform for an American one and was given the rank of Brigadier General. The AVG pilots, who had held the fort in Burma for so long against impossible odds, scattered far and wide. Few of them elected to remain in China. Those who did formed the nucleus of the new 23rd Fighter Group, still flying war-weary P-40s. A few names followed. Charles Older, Tex Hill, Ed Rector, and Gil Bright. What interested me was the fact that the AVG pilots were recruited by the Central Aircraft Manufacturing Company between April and July 1941. All of them were serving U.S. military personnel bound to CAMCO by a one-year contract. But Bucky had told me Chester remembered his father arriving home after 2 years overseas in time for his fourth birthday party, August 17, 1944. Because he was so specific, the date had stuck in my mind, and I jotted it down on an index card. The problem was, the AVG had already been out of business for 2 years at that point. So where did the truth lie? Had Johnny actually served with the AVG? More important, had he served at all? Chester would see the discrepancy in dates as confirmation of his theory. I could just imagine his response. Hell, the AVG was just a cover story. I could have told you that. Chester probably envisioned his father parachuting behind enemy lines, perhaps even feigning capture so he could confer with the Japanese high command. On the other hand, if he'd never been in the service, then maybe he'd only acquired the book so he could bullshit about the subject. And that might explain why he was unwilling to talk about the war. It was always going to be risky, because he might well run into someone who'd been in the very unit he was claiming to have served. By creating the impression of government secrecy, he could account for his reluctance to discuss the details that might give him away. I scanned the backyard, staring at the Ford Fairlane sitting up on concrete blocks. Why did I care one way or the other? The old guy was dead. If it comforted his son and his grandson to believe he was a war hero, or more grandiose yet, a spy whose cover had gone undetected now for more than 40 years, what difference did it make to me? I wasn't being paid to shoot holes in Johnny's story. I wasn't being paid to do anything. So why not let it drop? Because it's contrary to my nature, said she to herself. I'm like a little terrier when it comes to the truth. I have to stick my nose down the hole and dig until I find out what's in there. Sometimes I get bitten, but that's the chance I'm usually willing to take. In some ways, I didn't care so much about the nature of the truth as knowing what it consisted of. I became aware of the big 6-inch key digging into my hip. I stretched my leg out and slid my hand into my jeans pocket. I pulled out the key and held it in my palm, hefting the weight. I rubbed my thumb along the darkened surface. I squinted at the tarnished metal, just as Babe had done. The name of the lock company seemed to be faintly stamped on the shaft, but I couldn't figure out what it said in this light. It didn't appear to be any of the lock companies I knew. Schlag, Westlock, Weiser, or Yale. The safe had been an AMSEC, strictly a combination lock, so I didn't think the key was in any way connected with that. I hauled myself to my feet and slid the key back in my pocket. I was restless, trying to figure out what to do until Chester got home. It was always possible his memory was faulty. I'd only heard the story from Bucky, and he might have gotten the dates wrong. Ray Rawson had told me he worked with Johnny in the boatyards just after the war started, which had to be sometime in 1942. It struck me as odd that someone who'd known Johnny in the olden days had suddenly shown up on the old man's doorstep. Despite the offhand explanation, I wondered if there was something else going on. The Lexington Hotel was located on a side street a block off Lower State Street near the beach. The structure was a chunky 5-story box of weary-looking yellow brick, spanning an arcade that ran across the ground floor. On one side of the building, a jagged crack, like a lightning bolt, staggered through the brick from the roof to the foundation, suggesting earthquake damage that probably dated back to 1925. The letters of the word Lexington descended vertically on a sign affixed to one corner of the building, a buzzing yellow band of neon with dead bugs in the loops. The marquee boasted, "Daily Maid, phone, color TV in every room." The entrance was flanked by a Mexican restaurant on one side and by a bar on the other. A blaring jukebox in each establishment competed for airspace, a jarring juxtaposition of Linda Ronstadt and Helen Reddy. I moved into a lobby that was sparsely furnished and smelled of bleach. 2 rows of potted fan palms were arranged on either side of a length of trampled-looking red carpet that heralded the path to the front desk. The desk clerk was not in evidence. I picked up the house phone and asked the operator to connect me with Ray Rawson's room. He answered after 2 rings, and I identified myself. We spoke briefly, and he directed me to his 4th-floor digs.
"Take the stairs. The elevator takes forever," he said as he hung up.
I took the stairs 2 at a time just to test my lung capacity. By the 2nd-floor landing, I was winded and had to slow down. I clung to the stair railing while I climbed the last flight. Being fit in one sport seems to have no bearing on any other. I know joggers who wouldn't last 20 minutes on a stationary bike, and swimmers who couldn't jog more than a mile without collapsing. I composed myself slightly before I knocked at 407. Ray opened the door with a buzzing portable electric shaver in his hand. He was barefoot, in chinos and a white T-shirt, his balding head still damp from the shower. The already closely clipped fringe of gray had been trimmed since yesterday. His smile was embarrassed, and the gap between his two front teeth gave him an air of innocence. He motioned me in.
"You're too quick. I was trying to get this done before you got all the way up here. Be right back."
He moved into the bathroom, the buzzing sound of the shaver fading as he closed the door. His room was spacious and plain. White walls, white bedspread, rough white cotton curtains pulled back on fat wooden rods. There were only two windows, but both were double wide, looking out onto the back side of the building across the alleyway. The carpet was gray and seemed relatively clean. The glimpse I had of the bathroom showed glossy white ceramic tile walls and a floor of 1-inch black and white hexagonals. Ray returned, smelling strongly of aftershave.
"This is not bad," I said, turning halfway around.
$50 a night. I asked about weekly rates just until I get a place of my own. I don't suppose Bucky said anything about the rental.
Not to me, I said. Did you hear they had a break-in?
Who did? You mean Bucky and them? When was this?
I gave him the Reader's Digest condensed version.